All right, we're tonight back in the book of Hebrews. It's been a few weeks since our last study, of course, because of the circumstance of the pastor's conference in Kenya for me, and I'm glad to be back in Hebrews tonight. Where we left off was at the end of verse 22 of chapter 11. I don't really like to leave off right in the middle of a chapter like we did, but circumstances required it. So for tonight, as always, I want to just give a very brief description of what's brought us to this point. Remember, what we're dealing with in this book, to rightly understand what's being written, I mean, we could isolate the verses that are ahead of us apart from the context of the book, and we'd gain great benefit just from studying the specific points that are clearly right on the surface of these verses that we're going to be looking at tonight. But by understanding the context, we're going to gain a little bit more understanding of why these verses are right here at this point in the writing of the letter. The Hebrews are struggling, the ones that are first receiving this letter. Their struggle is really, if you boil it down, as we get to this point in the letter, it's a struggle of faith. And their struggle happens to be because of the circumstance they find themselves in. It's not a circumstance of their own choosing. It's not a circumstance of their own doing. They haven't, in a sense, put themselves in this position, but they find themselves in it. And the circumstance is one of persecution. There is this great pressure that's being brought to bear on their lives because of the reaction of the community around them to their faith in Jesus as Messiah, as the fulfillment of all that the Old Testament and Old Covenant had promised for the people of God. And in this circumstance of persecution, some of them, not all, but some of them are starting to crack or crumble under the pressure. And in their crumbling under the pressure, some of them have been tempted to move away from a public confession of Jesus as Messiah, thinking in their minds and hearts that they will find refuge by retreating back exclusively to the Old Testament and the law and Moses. And in doing so, what they're hoping is if we just re-identify ourselves as believers in the law, believers in Moses, followers of God's ways throughout history, then the community surrounding us is going to stop persecuting us for our Christian commitment to Jesus as Messiah. Now, Paul, as the apostle of the Lord, is doing his spiritual diligence, his due diligence, to write this letter in order to rescue their hearts from that false and foolish decision to let go of their heart's anchor to Christ in order to reattach their confidence to Moses and the law. Moses and the law, and we've seen this already in the book, are not being set up in the book as something wrong or something anti-Christ. Moses and the law are both wonderful servants of the Lord in their own rights, but they served a provisional purpose to lead us to Christ, to prepare our hearts for Christ. And only in Christ can our hearts find true peace, true refuge, and the relationship with the Lord that our hearts desire. And so what Paul's done throughout the letter is he's laid out an amazing ironclad case for the superiority of Christ to not just Moses, but to every aspect of Old Covenant life. And he has exhorted them, he's urged them to not turn their backs on Christ and back to the law. He has, at this point in the letter, having exhorted them, having taught them, even strongly warned them, he's now encouraging their hearts. And he's doing so in chapter 11 by taking them through just a brief overview. I mean, we've got a long chapter here. It's 40 verses, but in comparison to all that the Old Testament represents, these 40 verses are, in a sense, a summary overview of the story of God's dealings with his people throughout the entire Old Testament era. But from one specific lens, and that's the lens of faith, looking at the story of how God's people were following the Lord in relationship to the grace of faith that he gave to their hearts in order to deal with the challenges that they faced in their lives. Paul's hope is, and right, it's a good hope, a well-founded hope, is that if they look back at the examples of these heroes of faith that we see represented in chapter 11, that these folks that he's writing to will find strength, they'll find encouragement to face their own specific challenge of faith that they're dealing with. It may not be the exact circumstance that Abraham, for instance, as we've already looked at his example, or Noah and the others that are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, it may not be the same circumstance of challenge that they faced in their own lives, but it's going to be similar in the sense of there's only one way to face any challenge that God appoints for us, and to successfully make it through that challenge, still faithful to him, walking with him, obedient to him, and that is by facing that challenge through the grace to believe in him, trust in him, to have faith in him and his word and his promises. So, that leads us up to the section for tonight's study, which begins in verse 23. We're going to tackle verses 23 through 29 tonight, and we'll call this the faith of Moses. So, Paul has given us several wonderful examples of faith from Old Testament history, and in a sense, he has chronologically been working his way through the Old Testament. Now he comes to the example of Moses himself, which is really the centerpiece of his set of examples. Moses being the most important example he could give to them. In a sense, even more important than Abraham, even though Abraham was the beginner of the walk of faith. He is the trailblazer of the walk of faith in Old Covenant history. But Moses, for these people that he's writing to, represents an even greater example, because Moses is the one that they're under this current pressure. They're considering turning back to refuge in trusting and following Moses. And so Paul is going to use Moses himself as an example of what it means to walk in true faith. So let's read these verses 23 through 29, and then we'll try to understand the key points that Paul is making using Moses as an example of what it truly means to walk in faith with the Lord, facing whatever challenge he has appointed for us. Hebrews 11:23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful. They were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. By faith the people crossed the Red Sea, as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. All right, so in using Moses as an example of faith, where Paul starts is really in an unusual place, and that is he starts at the birth or infancy story of Moses, when Moses himself is not actually exercising any faith, because at the point of the story that he starts in verse 23, it's Moses' first 3 months of life, and he's just going through this circumstance without any awareness of the Lord and certainly not exercising any personal faith in the Lord. Nevertheless, it's interesting that in the way that Paul describes this circumstance of Moses' infancy, these first 3 months of his life, he says it this way: by faith Moses, when he was born. And it's really a point or a story about the faith of Moses, even though Moses himself is not exercising it, and the emphasis shifts from Moses to the parents of Moses, both his father and mother. And so the author here under inspiration of the Spirit of God, is connecting the faith of his parents with the faith of Moses that would eventually be seen or eventually displayed in his life. Even though Moses is technically not exercising this faith and his parents are, it's being credited in a sense to Moses because it's part of the story of Moses. And Paul's point is, if you look at the life of Moses in the Old Testament, you read from beginning of his life to end of his life, and if you were to try to characterize the story of his life using theological categories, you would have to arrive at the conclusion that the story of Moses is a story of faith. Now, this is important because Moses is, generally speaking, considered to be, and rightly so, a man of the law. And we consider Moses to be a man of the law for what reason? He was, in his own special assignment from the Lord, he was the lawgiver. Now, of course, we know that Moses didn't invent the law. He didn't come up with the law. He didn't determine it for himself. He was given the law as a messenger of the Lord, in a sense acting like the Lord's high-level spiritual secretary, writing down exactly what the Lord revealed to him on Mount Sinai, summarized, of course, by the two tablets of the law that the Lord wrote with his own hand, and then, of course, filled out with greater detail in all 613 individual laws that we rightly identify both as the law of God and the law of Moses. So calling it the law of Moses tells us Moses was a man of the law. But Paul's point here in this section is, if you really read the story of the life of Moses through right spiritual eyes or perspective, what you're going to see is not so much a story of law, you're going to see a story of faith. Because here, faith was present at the very beginning of the life of Moses, way before the law was present. Though the law was in the heart and mind of God and intended to be revealed later on Mount Sinai, at this point in his story, the law had not yet been revealed at all, and yet here is Moses in a true relationship of faith on, in a sense, on the shoulders of his parents' heart and faith toward the Lord. Now, the first thing I want to highlight here is that in looking at the life story of Moses as a story of faith, Paul is not just simply, like any of the other characters of the Old Testament that have been in focus in chapter 11 up until now, he's not just simply writing general concepts of their heart's perspective to the Lord, as though he's describing, you know, Moses, if you look at his life, he was a man of faith, he had a heart of faith, he loved the Lord, he trusted in the Lord, he believed in the Lord. He doesn't say any of that. The only reason why we can be 100% confident and sure that Moses was a man of faith and that his life story really is a story of faith is by looking at the faith that was on display in the specific context of certain circumstances that exposed the faith that was in the hearts, in this case, of his parents, and in the next verses that follow, in the heart of Moses himself. In other words, it was the challenging circumstances of his life that revealed and put on display the authenticity, the genuine nature of his true faith. And without those challenging circumstances, we would simply be guessing as to whether or not Moses was really a man of faith or just like any other ordinary and normal human being. So the first lesson, and this doesn't just apply to Moses, this applies to all the Old Testament individuals that have been mentioned so far in the chapter up until verse 23, and it will also apply to all those that are going to be mentioned after this. Once we're finished with this section, the story is going to shift to the conquest of the promised land in verse 30. Rahab, the prostitute, is going to be mentioned in verse 32, just jumping ahead. Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, they're all going to be mentioned and they're going to be highlighted as individuals of faith. But in each case, every single person that's mentioned as a person of faith in this chapter, we know and see their faith in the specific context of them facing challenges that were beyond their natural and human ability to deal with were it not for their faith in the Lord. Their faith in the Lord really defines them as a person because they had to pass through deep challenges that stretched them to their personal limits, and in some cases beyond their what we would consider to be natural limits, to bring them into supernatural territory of there's only one way they could have made it through this, and that's by faith in the Lord, in His Word, and in His promises. All right, so the point for us is, if we consider ourselves to be, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but you're all here at a Bible study tonight. And so I'm confident that in your own self-evaluation, you would consider yourself to be and label yourself to be a person of faith. And the issue is, we all consider ourselves to be people of faith, but how can we know with confidence? How can we know with a sense of certainty that we truly are people of faith? And the answer to that is the same as if we were to ask that question of any of these that have been named in Hebrews chapter 11 so far, including Moses now. And that is, how do we respond when we're put under such intense personal pressure by being led into, by the Lord Himself, circumstances beyond our capacity to handle them in our own natural resources, our own natural wisdom, and our own natural strength? How do we handle that circumstance? And the answer to that, if we're people of faith, is we handle it by faith. We handle it by faith in the Lord, in what He's revealed in His Word, and the promises He's previously given to us. And there are moments when we pass through those level of challenges that's the only thing that gets us from point A to point B, is our faith in Him. And so we're meant to now read this story of Moses from that perspective, to look at these highlighted moments and circumstances of the life story of Moses from the standpoint of, would I handle myself in a similar way if I were in that circumstance? And if I would, it's only because by the grace of God I have the same kind of faith that the parents of Moses had, or that Moses himself had. Now, my circumstances are not going to be this that we're reading here. Like the very first one, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. It's important for us, of course, to remember what the king's edict was. Pharaoh's edict was, because he was concerned at the proliferation of the Hebrew population that lived within the boundaries of his domain in Egypt, he was concerned that the Hebrews were going to eventually outnumber the Egyptians. And once the Hebrews outnumbered the Egyptians, he was concerned that he might lose control of his own kingdom. And so he made a naturally motivated decision as a king that he was going to do something about the problem before the problem ever happened. And what he was going to do was, he was going to limit the population of the Israelites, the Hebrews. He chose to do so by issuing an edict, and the edict was, every male child born to this group of people, we're going to kill. We're going to execute every male child. And that way we'll ensure that we still have a population, because the females will still be available, but at the same time, we don't have to deal with all these male children rising up within our kingdom and causing problems. And so this edict was a significant edict. Can you imagine putting yourself in a country, a nation, that would make such a ruling? It would be as if the president of the United States made a ruling that said, every Christian child, male child that's born, is now going to be executed. And you're in that nation, and it's not a circumstance that you can just get up and leave. You're there. How are you going to respond to that? How are you going to deal with that? And so the idea here, of course, is there's only one way that the Lord has ordained for us to deal with that or any other similar kind of circumstance that would challenge us to our core and beyond our natural resource, and that is by faith. So by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. Now let's read, we'll keep our place here in Hebrews, but let's read a couple of passages that briefly describe that portion of the story for us. Let's first go back to the original account in Exodus chapter 1, just to fill in some of the details of the actual circumstance. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 22. I'll read from there, through to chapter 2, verse 3. And this starts, Exodus 1, 22 starts with the king's or the Pharaoh's edict that Hebrews is referencing. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile. But you shall let every daughter live. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. That's that time period that's referenced in Hebrews 11. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. You're familiar with the story as it unfolds from there. The child in that basket floats down the river to a location where one of the daughters of Pharaoh sees the basket. She's interested in it. She calls for it to be brought to her, discovers this baby in the basket, and chooses to adopt the baby into her family, and therefore he becomes a child or a son of Pharaoh's daughter and becomes rightfully so one of the princes of Egypt. All right, so let's turn from the Exodus passage now all the way forward into the New Testament, and let's read just one verse from the book of Acts chapter 7. This passage is of course taken from a trial circumstance, and it was the trial of the first martyr of the early Christian church, Stephen, being put on trial for his faith in Christ. And as part of his opportunity to give a personal defense under trial, he took those that were trying him through a brief Old Testament survey lesson. And he has a particularly powerful conclusion to his summary or survey of the Old Testament events. But we won't read that. We're just going to focus on the specific comment that he makes about Moses. And I'm going to read Acts 7:20. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight. And he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. All right, so the circumstance is, we can return to our Hebrews passage. The circumstances we're dealing with, Moses, when he was born, hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful. Now, that's somewhat of a mysterious description to us. And I honestly, having studied it, having read all of the best commentaries on that particular phrasing in the Hebrews passage, I still don't think I have a 100% clear grasp of why this is described in this way for us. There's something, though, and this much is obvious, there's something about the appearance of Moses, this young baby. He's 3 months old, this young child, and his parents are observing him growing up as a baby, and they receive an edict, just like all the other Hebrew families received in Egypt. And the edict is, you're to take all of these male children that have just been born, and you're to throw them into the Nile River for the sake of allowing that child to drown and die. And in seeing their son, they see something in him that in one passage in Exodus is described as Moses himself was so beautiful to look at that they couldn't bear to carry out the king's edict. In the second passage, which is in the book of Acts, we have somewhat of a commentary that's provided for us by Stephen. And Stephen, of course, was speaking not just out of his imagination. He himself was speaking under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. We know that because the writer of the book of Acts records his exact statement under trial and records it as truly a word from the Lord for the circumstance that he found himself in. And in Stephen's description, it's interesting that he adds one additional detail, which was, it wasn't just that Moses was a more physically beautiful child than average, but that he was beautiful in God's sight, as it's described in the book of Acts. Now, how it is exactly that the parents looking at their child saw that, we don't know. We don't know the mechanism behind how they reached that conclusion. Because on a natural level, you know how it is. Even if parents who love their children, and we're talking about good parents here, of course, even if parents who love their children happen to have a less than most beautiful baby, they'll look at their own child and they will view that child as a beautiful child because that child is beautiful to them. And that's an operation of parental love. There's nothing wrong with that. That's absolutely a blessing for them to look at their own child in that way. And parents tend to look more favorably on the physical features of their own children than they do anyone else's children. Why is that? I think it's just a natural perspective, because by looking more favorably on your own offspring, in a sense, you're looking more favorably on yourself. And that's just normal, natural for people to do that. But I think this is something more going on here. And it's clear because both the Exodus passage and the Acts passage seem to highlight this perspective, emphasize this perspective. And so what I'm concluding from it, especially based upon Stephen's commentary, that Moses was, in the eyes of his parents, not just in the eyes of, you know, friends and family that were coming by and saying, wow, you've got a really good-looking child here, but something that they were seeing in Moses caused them to discern that he was beautiful in God's sight. In other words, I believe that by faith, and this is only by faith through the grace of the Lord, they saw a special purpose that the Lord had for their child. Even though he's only a baby, even though he's only 3 months old, even though they have no clear and certain script of the future in front of their eyes, they're spiritually sensing or discerning that the Lord has a special and beautiful purpose for him. And because of that, they see greater beauty in him. Now, in that context, the king's edict comes. Take your child and throw him in the Nile River. And they're left to weigh these two options. I can only imagine that for every Hebrew family, this was a tremendously, deeply difficult circumstance, challenging circumstance. Can you imagine? I own a dog. And if the king said by edict, you must execute your dog by throwing your dog into the Nile River in order for your dog to die in the Nile River, I would have a very difficult time obeying that edict of the king. Now, if you said, do that for your own flesh and blood son, that your baby, your infant son that has just been brought into the world, it's just something beyond capacity if you are a truly loving parent to do something like that. Yet what's implied in the backstory here, we don't have all the details written out for us, but it's clearly inferred or implied in the text or in the way the story is told. Apparently, other Hebrew parents did exactly this. Now, of course, the Hebrew midwives were working by the grace of God behind the scenes in order to hide many of the births of Hebrew children from Pharaoh's eyes. But nevertheless, the king had put an edict out, and not everyone, as Hebrew parents, did what the parents of Moses did in this circumstance. So they've received the king's edict. They're looking at their child, and they're seeing a beautiful, purpose, a spiritual purpose that the Lord has for their child, and they're weighing two things against each other. The king's edict didn't specify what would happen to any parents that disobeyed his order, but we can imagine what would happen to parents that disobeyed his order. Pharaohs weren't typically known as the most lenient of kings in the ancient world. You issue a nationwide edict such as this, and the likelihood, and we see how Pharaohs act later in the Exodus story, the likelihood is if he discovers any Hebrew parents that are disobeying his edict, then they are taking their lives into their own hands, meaning they are going to be subject to the most severe punishments by the Egyptian king. And so the parents, even knowing what it might cost them, are described in this way. And they were not, at the end of verse 23, they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now I think I want to take the risk of reading something into this verse. I think in one sense I don't want to necessarily say they were afraid of the king's edict, but I think they were very concerned about the king's edict. I don't think they heard the king's edict and then said to themselves, that's nothing. That's nothing to be worried about. That's nothing to be concerned about. Who cares about the king's edict? I don't think they disregarded the king's edict in that way. I think what they did was they sat down and prayerfully weighed two things against each other. And one thing was, we can honor and obey the king of Egypt, and we can execute our own flesh and blood son, in whom we see God's special purpose, and we can throw him into the river Nile and not just see his life that we love ended, but see that purpose that the Lord has invested in him spiritually for the future die along with our son in the Nile River. Or we can obey a greater and higher king, a greater and higher authority who is the Lord himself, and put ourselves in the place of risking the earthly king's wrath for the sake of trusting in and obeying a higher and heavenly king. And really, when it boils down to it, this is one of the basic lessons of true faith. One of the basic lessons of true faith is true faith will bring you in such circumstances to a place where you have to evaluate in a cost-benefit kind of spiritual evaluation, which pathway am I going to take next? And most of the time, faith will take you down the path not of least resistance, but the path of most resistance. Not the path of least cost to you personally, but the path that will at least put you in threat of experiencing the greatest personal cost. And that's what faith did for the parents of Moses, but they chose that path because they valued the Lord's pleasure and the Lord's purpose above Pharaoh's pleasure and Pharaoh's purpose. And so they hid their son by faith. And as a result, the life story of Moses starts as an amazing story of faith in his family background. Now, verse 24, we're fast-forwarding in the story. We're some 40 years later in the story. And we see this. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Now, I want to characterize this section of verses that I just read by some key words that are in focus here. Moses refused something. Moses chose something. Moses considered something. And fourth, Moses looked to something. And those four key words really describe for us what the exercise of real biblical spiritual faith was all about in Moses' circumstance as he grew to adulthood and faced his first great personal challenge in what led to his own heart's walk with the Lord and ultimately the fulfillment of his assignment. These four key words, of course, are helpful to us because it's one thing, you know how it is, if you're going through some challenging circumstance, it's not going to be the same challenge that Moses faced, but it's your own challenge, the one that the Lord has appointed for you. And it's the one that's taking you right to the limit of your own personal resources, and it's taking you right to the edge of what you think you can handle. And your brothers and sisters around you wanting to encourage you and strengthen you in your moment of trial will often say things to you like, just trust the Lord in this circumstance. Have faith in the Lord. Have faith in His Word. Have faith in His promises. And those encouragements are all good and necessary and helpful and useful. But what I want you to understand that there's details that are critically important for your heart to focus on and be anchored in other than just a generic phrasing of trust in the Lord, have faith in the Lord. It's one thing to say that, but it's another thing to actually, in the moment of greatest personal challenge, to effectively, really walk in faith. And these four key terms kind of fill out some information for us that help us to understand the nuts and bolts of what it means to really walk in faith when you're in that moment of great challenge. So the first word, refuse. Moses, when he grew up, when the Lord appointed for his challenge to happen, Moses made a decision, and his decision led him to a personal refusal of something that was available to him, convenient for him, and something that was actually more personally enjoyable for him. And he chose to refuse it. Now, what we're dealing with here, of course, even though the specifics are not mentioned in the text, the part of the story of Moses that we're talking about here is that moment as an adult, as a prince of Egypt, when Moses saw, and you know the story, you know the circumstance, he saw one of the Israelites who was serving as a slave to Pharaoh being mistreated by one of the servants of Pharaoh, one of the overseers of the slaves. And he made a decision in that circumstance to identify himself with the people of God and with the Hebrews, who were a slave nation, rather than continuing to identify himself as a prince of Egypt in a position of authority, in a position of privilege, in a position of personal convenience and enjoyment. Now, of course, we know that in that circumstance, Moses didn't handle the circumstance in all the best ways. He reacted naturally. While this response of faith was going on in him, he was also reacting naturally at the same time, and it led him to actually kill that overlord, that slave master, and attempt to hide his body in that circumstance. But the writer here, Paul, is not focused on that natural aspect of what was going on in Moses' heart, because he was not fully spiritually mature at this point. He was not entirely sanctified at this point. He was just at the beginning of his own heart's relationship with the Lord. But what he is focused on is what was motivating him to move in that direction to help the Hebrew slave. And what was motivating him was not just a brief, momentary flash of pity. As a prince, looking at a slave within his domain and taking pity in a brief moment on that slave. He was looking at that slave and connecting to that slave, recognizing that that slave's people were really his people and he belonged to them, and he was willing to stand up on behalf of that slave to attempt to rescue that slave from his circumstance because of the motivation that was going on in his heart. And the first thing that was motivating him was a decision that he made in that moment. This is all happening in a moment's time in his heart. But in making the decision to stand up in that circumstance and move to help that slave, he was choosing to refuse something. And what he was choosing to refuse was this. By faith, when he was grown up, Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now understand this. This is all backstory that we're given, being given here by Paul as he's writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. There's nowhere in the Hebrew text, the Exodus text, when you go back and actually read the account, where Moses stood up one day in the royal court and said, I have come to a decision as an adult son of Pharaoh. I have come to a decision. I am no longer going to be identified as a son of Pharaoh's daughter. I am going to be identified as an Israelite. It wasn't formal in that way. It wasn't thought out in a long, protracted way. It was a momentary decision, but a real one, motivated by a heart that was more focused on the people of God and the God over those people than it was his own personal circumstance of privilege and convenience as a prince of Egypt. So first he refused. Now what that represents for us is this. When you're in a challenge of faith, the Lord will give you the opportunity to choose the path of convenience or to refuse the path of convenience. And the path of convenience is this for us. It's the path of handling the challenge the way the world would versus handling the challenge the way the Lord calls you to handle that challenging circumstance. One way is more convenient. One way is the easier path. The other way is more difficult. It's more dangerous. But one way honors the Lord and one way doesn't honor the Lord. And so the first response of faith in his heart was a response of refusing to be called or to be identified with the world. And in this case, that represented being a son of Pharaoh's daughter. Second, and this is immediate, this is not like one day he refused and then 3 months, 6 months later he chose. This refusal is immediately followed and linked to a heart-level choice that he was making. He refused, he disconnected from his privileged position in Egypt, and at the same time he chose, as it says here, by faith Moses, when he was grown, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Now, Moses did not become a slave in this moment, like the people of God. But in the pathway that he chose, in the actions that he chose, he was identifying himself with them, and had he remained in that circumstance, what would have inevitably happened if he had not lost his life by being executed by Pharaoh, he would have been included among the slave nation of the Hebrews, losing all of his privileges and all of the pleasures, the corresponding pleasures that go along with being identified as a prince of Egypt. So there is this dual thing that's going on here, refusing connection with the way of the world and choosing instead to identify with the people of God, which is locking himself into an option in terms of personal pathway into the future of, I'm going to do things the way the Lord calls me to do things. I'm going to identify myself with the people of God and the God over his people rather than with the Egyptians. Next, we see this, verse 26. We don't know how long this consideration lasted, but it identifies for us that he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. For he was looking to the reward. He considered. So this is my take on the description that Paul is making of what was going on in the heart and mind of Moses, because that's what really Paul's writing about here. He's giving us a glimpse into the internal workings of what was going on in the mind and heart of Moses at the moment that he made this decision. He refused, he chose, and he at the same time considered. Now, the consideration that's in view here is not a horizontal consideration. The refusal was, I'm refusing to be identified any longer with the Egyptians. and with being named a son of Pharaoh's daughter and a prince of Egypt. And I'm choosing instead, horizontally, to identify myself with the people of God. But the consideration takes him into a higher level perspective, because this consideration is more of a vertical consideration. He's considering his relationship with the Lord over God's people. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. Now, this phrasing here, the reproach of Christ, has given some commentators a bit of trouble. And there are some different ideas about what Paul has in mind when he says that. Because obviously, Christ was not physically on the scene during this circumstance in the life of Moses. His birth was yet hundreds of years into the future. And yet he calls what the Israelites that were alive in those days in Egypt, the circumstance of difficulty that they were facing in their enslavement to Pharaoh, he's calling their circumstance the reproach of Christ. And I think the only right way to understand that is that these are ultimately the people of God, and their purpose in being identified by the Lord as the people of God is ultimately leading us to a historical culmination point. That historical culmination point is not going to be seen yet until many years into the future, but this is all leading, the story of the Old Testament is all ultimately leading to the birth and the arrival of Christ into this world. And he himself is going to bear the greatest reproach for fulfilling the purposes of God in the earth. And so all of the people of God that we identify as Israelites, faithful Israelites, throughout all of Old Testament history, are in a sense sharing the reproach of Christ, because they are the people of God that are participating in this grand purpose of God to bring Christ into the world. And so Moses, in this singular moment, this life-defining moment that disconnects him from being a prince of Egypt, re-identifies him as a true Israelite, is happening ultimately not just because he's looking at the Israelites on the left and looking at the Egyptians on the right, but ultimately he's making this decision because his attention is focused in a more heavenward direction. He's considering the reproach of Christ's greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. Here again, we're back to this concept of a cost-benefit spiritual analysis. He's weighing the benefit of two things. The two things he's weighing are, on the one hand, the treasures of Egypt. On the other hand, the heavenly reward of living my life to fulfill the assignment that the Lord has given me, with that being my great treasure, instead of any earthly benefit I might gain from living life on my own terms. And he weighs those two things out, and by the grace of God, which is producing real faith in his heart in that key moment, he rightly refuses, he rightly chooses, and he rightly considers, and at the end, and this is all happening in a life-defining, life-changing single moment of time, he makes the decision, I'm going with God, and I'm going with God's people, and I'm leaving the world behind, and all that it has meant to me so far in my life. Now in verse 27, we read this. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Now this verse is a little bit problematic for us. It doesn't mean that we can't reach a right understanding of it, but it's a little bit problematic at first reading, because if we're reading this from a strictly, this story of the life of Moses through the lens of faith, if we're reading it from a strictly chronological perspective, you know how it is as we describe our own personal life story to other people, we tend to describe circumstances in a chronological way. You know, I was born here, I grew up here, then this happened to me, then that happened to me, this changed my life, and then, you know, that led me to this present moment. But here, what we have is a circumstance where we see Moses leave Egypt, but then this descriptor is attached to his leaving. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. Now, if we go back and read the actual story of the exit of Moses immediately following his intervention to rescue the Hebrew victim from being mistreated and abused by his Hebrew slave master, Moses rises up, he strikes the Hebrew slave master, kills him in the process, and then what does he do next? Do you remember? He before he runs away, he tries to hide the body, he tries to bury the body to cover the tracks of, because he knows, as the text tells us, that Pharaoh's not going to be thrilled by what he's just done. And so he's trying to cover his tracks. And then when he realizes that he has not been able to successfully cover the circumstance, word gets back to Pharaoh, he knows he's in trouble. And that trouble is most likely going to lead, at the very least, to a dramatically changed life circumstance, and most likely even lead to his own execution. So what does he do? He runs away. He leaves Egypt and he runs out into the wilderness of Sinai. And he exits stage left, or stage right, so to speak. And when he does so, is he, as this is describing in verse 27, is he not afraid of the anger of the king as he leaves Egypt? And the answer is, if you read the text, you read the story back in Exodus, I won't take us back and read that portion of the story, but it very clearly indicates in the story that Moses left for one reason and one reason only. He left because he was afraid of what the king would do to him. So you have an apparent contradiction here, and it creates a problem for us, until and unless we consider the fact that Moses had two exits from Egypt in the course of his life story. He left Egypt twice. The first time he was 40 years old when he rose up and he struck the Egyptian overlord, hid the body, finds out that the king knows what he's done, and he flees into the wilderness. Second time is some 40 years later, after a 40-year period of living in the wilderness, now as a shepherd, having found a wife and raised a family, he is encountering the Lord at the famous burning bush encounter, in which the Lord appears to him, the Lord speaks to him, the Lord commissions him, and the Lord sends him back to Egypt in order to deliver the children of Israel out of Egypt as their deliverer. And he goes back to Egypt, and there's a whole scenario of his time there in Egypt, the second time in Egypt. And of course, that leads through the whole story, the extended story of the 10 plagues, these 10 great supernatural judgments that the Lord brings upon the nation of Egypt, ultimately leading to Pharaoh saying to him, go ahead and take the Israelites and leave, get out of here, I can't handle any more of this. And so Moses at that point leaves. So the question is, which of these two leavings is being described here? I am 100% convinced that the leaving that's in focus in verse 27 is the second leaving, with Moses now 80 years old rather than 40 years old. I don't believe this is describing the first time he left Egypt, because the first time he was afraid of the king, and that was the motivator for him fleeing Egypt. The second time he left Egypt, but as he left Egypt, his heart and his character are in an entirely different place. And he's not leaving out of fear of Pharaoh, even though he knows in his heart that by taking the entire nation of Israelites out of Egypt, he is going to basically ruin the Egyptian economy, and there are going to be repercussions. There is going to be a threat to Israel based upon the reaction of Pharaoh. And we see those circumstances play out right there at the Red Sea incident, which is the very next thing that's being addressed in this passage. So I'm convinced that here we're dealing with the second leaving, the leaving after the burning bush incident, the leaving after the 40 years of character formation and walking with the Lord on the backside of the wilderness, as it's described in the text. So let's reread that with this this second scenario in our perspective. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. Okay, next lesson of faith here is true faith obliterates fear in your heart. There's always natural reasons to be afraid. If your particular challenge of faith is a financial one, there's always natural reasons to be concerned at the least and worried and afraid at the most that you won't have enough money. If your challenge of faith is a physical one, there's always reason to be concerned about your physical welfare and well-being and your health. And yet, the idea here is that true faith is going to respond in whatever circumstance of challenge that you find yourself in, not being afraid of the circumstance surrounding you on a horizontal level, but instead your heart being anchored and fixed to a greater concern. A concern that takes your heart above, and your mind with it, above the natural fear that would ordinarily overwhelm your heart. And so, by faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. And then this one little word in the text, it's a connector word from the previous phrase to the next one, but it's critically important for our understanding. For he endured, as seeing him who is invisible. That word for tells us that what he says at the end of verse 27 explains how it is that he did the beginning of verse 27. So Moses was not afraid of Pharaoh the second time, and the reaction, the response of Pharaoh the second time he left Egypt with the Israelites in tow behind him. And he was not afraid of Pharaoh the second time like he was the first time. What's the difference? What's the change in his heart and his perspective? Why is it that he is not afraid now when he was afraid before? And the difference is, in his heart and in his mind, he clearly, spiritually sees something that he did not clearly see 40 years prior as a much younger man. What he sees now is this. He sees him who is invisible. And in that perspective, his spiritual, what Paul later calls the eyes of the heart, with his perspective locked on the Lord, him who is invisible, he finds grace to endure the circumstance without caving in to natural fears that would ordinarily overwhelm him in that circumstance. And had you and I been in that same circumstance, we would naturally be overwhelmed by fear. I mean, it's easy for us to look back because we look at Moses kind of like how we look at characters in superhero movies now. He's kind of like a biblical superhero. I mean, he's doing miracles and you know, he's got this staff and he holds out the staff over the Red Sea and the entire sea parts. I mean, there's just amazing, awesome miracles being done. But he was a real man in a real circumstance, and he was sent by the Lord to go and confront the most powerful political and military figure on the face of the earth at that time in history, and to tell him, I am, without saying it in so many words, I'm about to ruin your entire nation's economy by evacuating the slave labor force that you depend on. And I'm taking them all out of here, and I'm doing so only because a voice spoke to me out of a burning bush and told me to do it. And I'm doing it because that's the way things are. The only way he could face that kind of challenge was because he was looking past, beyond, through, in a sense, these natural horizontal circumstances of the threats of Pharaoh. And he was locked in his perspective on, as it's described here, him who is invisible. So, the lesson of faith here for us is that faith sees the unseen. We've encountered earlier in chapter 11 the principle that true faith is always faith in the unseen. You know, we walk by faith, not by sight. We know this principle, we hear this principle, we repeat the principle to ourselves, But understand, when you face your own greatest personal challenge, it's going to be critically important that you remember that principle and you apply it, because it will be the make or break principle of how you respond to that circumstance. We walk by faith, not by sight, which implies that those principles are in some sense set at odds with each other. It doesn't mean we disregard what is seen, ignore what is seen, pretend that what is seen isn't real. It's real. It's a real issue. It's a real concern. It's a real threat to our welfare and our future. But we're looking past that, beyond that, and we're anchoring our heart's perspective to what is not seen, to what the person to the right of us and the person to the left of us would look at and say, I don't see why it is that you can make this decision in your life, why it is that you can trust and not be afraid in this circumstance, because they can't see what is unseen unless they have grace from God to do so. But your heart must, in those moments, be anchored to what is unseen rather than dependent upon what is seen. Let me read this passage for you. You don't have to turn there. This is also from the Apostle Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18, which just is a summary of this principle. In fact, I'll read 16 through 18 to just get the flow of the point that he makes. So we do not lose heart. And I would just say this, when the Lord brings you through the deeply challenging circumstances in your own life pathway that is similar to the kind of thing that Moses was facing, that's a circumstance that would naturally speaking tend to influence you to the point of losing heart. But Paul says, so we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look, focusing our eyes, the eyes of our hearts, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. So the lesson of the life of Moses, the faith story of Moses, is a lesson of anchoring your perspective to that which is unseen. All right, now let's move a little further. We're still in chapter 11, and that brings us to verse 28. And we're right at the circumstance now of this second leaving of Moses from Egypt. For by faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. Now, it is true, of course, that Moses kept the Passover, but I don't think that word in our translation fully captures the point that is being made here about what Moses was doing. All of Israel, on the night of the Passover, the first great Passover, and we're in the circumstance now of Exodus chapters 12 and 13, we won't go back. It's a long story. We won't go back and read the whole account, of course. But you're familiar with the story. It's that night of the 10th plague, the 10th and culminating final supernatural judgment that the Lord brought upon the nation of Egypt, that finally moved Pharaoh to release the Israelites as the Lord had commanded. And in this circumstance, the Lord has warned Moses to go and to tell all of the Israelites to gather in their homes on this night and to not leave their homes. But before they get in their homes and lock the door, so to speak, for the night, they're to sacrifice a lamb. They're to take the blood of this sacrificed lamb, and they're to paint three key points around the door frame of the front entry to their home. They're to in a sense, paint the entry to their home with the blood of this sacrificed lamb. Then they're to go and hunker down in their homes that night, not leaving the house because the Lord warned that he was sending a destroyer across the entire nation of Egypt, and that he would, this destroyer would execute every firstborn child, which is really an echo of what started this whole story all the way back at the birth account of Moses. But that the Lord would execute the firstborn son of every Egyptian household, with the exception of homes that were covered by this blood of the lamb at the entrance to their home. So this is the circumstance that's being described here. And we see by faith he kept the Passover. The entire nation kept the Passover. I'm talking about the Israelites, the people of God kept the Passover that night and survived the circumstances of their night, all of their firstborn sons surviving that circumstance. Moses kept it as well, but he did more than keep it. He's the one that actually started this pattern of what became known as the Passover. And later, of course, that was codified for the people of God in the law of God and the law of Moses, and it was ordained by the Lord as a feast day that was to be repeated every calendar year on a specific night, the anniversary of this exact night, and it was to be honored and followed and faithfully celebrated by the people of God for all of the generations of their history to come in perpetuity. And the point is that what Moses did that night was not just keep the Passover, but he instituted it. He began it. And the particular verb tense that Paul uses to describe the institution of the Passover that Moses brought about is what we call in the Greek text the perfect verb tense. This simply describes an action that takes place that one night, but it continues in its effect or force on into the future. It never stops having an influence from the moment that this action is first done. So we should read it along these lines. By faith, he instituted the Passover so that the Passover continued to have an impact and an influence on the people of God throughout all of their days and all of their generations in the future to follow. The point is that Moses did this by faith. He instituted something that wouldn't just have an effect on them that night. He instituted something that would redefine them as a people, as a nation, really re-identify them from slaves to children of God. It would make them, it would identify them as God's holy nation, as his special and chosen people among all the nations on the face of the earth. And this was all based in the faith of Moses that gave him perspective to see not just what God had provided for that moment's rescue, but for all of history to follow. And so his perspective that was causing him to see the unseen led him to institute something by action that went against all natural perspective. It went against logic. It went against, I mean, if you can put yourself in this position, just imagine what it was like that night. Before the destroyer flies over the nation and begins to execute firstborn sons, Moses had to call all of the children of Israel together. He had to call the leaders of Israel together, and he had to say, listen, I'm giving you an instruction that you need to follow, and here's what you need to do this night. You need to, each one of you as a family, sacrifice a lamb, take the blood, and paint the outside frame of your door on the outside, then go into your house, and whatever you do, don't leave the house tonight. How do you think the people might think about him given that kind of instruction? If I were to say to you tonight, listen, everybody, when you leave the Bible study tonight, go get a lamb, and I want you to kill it and gather its blood. And then, you know that nice paint job you've just put on the outside of your house? I want you to ruin it because I want you to paint blood on the outside of your house. And then I want you to get into your house, and whatever you do, don't leave the house that night. What would you think about me? You would think, yeah, there's something a little bit off with Moses here. There's something a little bit off. There, you know, this is strange stuff. And Moses was willing to take this risk. He was willing to be faithful to institute the Lord's command for the people of God. And by the grace of God alone, somehow he was able to convince the people to follow his instructions and to do what he told them to do. And of course, I think that they found good reason to do so, because this was, of course, the 10th of the plagues. They had the evidence of 9 previous supernatural outbreaks in the nation of Egypt to give them at least a head start of thinking, eh, maybe we should be paying attention to what this Moses guy has to say this time. We've seen 9 amazing evidences that the Lord is at work through this man's life and through these instructions that he's giving us. But for him, it's all based in a supernatural, heavenly perspective in which his heart was locked in to the unseen. All right, we have one verse left, verse 29. By faith, the people of God, or the people, crossed the Red Sea as on dry land. But the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. Now, there's a whole story involved here, and I wish we had time to read the entire story. But I think there's something in this story that's important for us to go back, at least capture just a few verses of the story that's being described here in verse 29. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 14, and we'll end our study in Exodus tonight. Exodus 14. Now, this is after, of course, the 10th plague. This is after the Passover. The children of Israel have now been released by Pharaoh. They have left Egypt, and they have now come to the edge of the Red Sea. We're going to start reading in Exodus chapter 14, verse 9. And I'm going to read through to verse 14. 14:9 through 14. Now they're camped right at the edge of the Red Sea. And we read in verse 9, the Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea by, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this, but Pi Hahiroth, in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they, that's the people, the Israelites, they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt?" Meaning before you took us out of Egypt. "Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." Now let me just ask you a question based upon what the people said to Moses in this critical moment. This is their moment of greatest challenge. This is their moment to display shining faith in the Lord and in his will and in his great purpose for their lives. And in verses 11 through 12, we see how they respond. In that brief description of how they responded and what they said to Moses in this moment of challenge, does that sound to you like hearts of anchored faith in the unseen King of heaven? What they're doing, of course, is they're grumbling and complaining about their circumstance. They're angry and upset with Moses for having caused the circumstance, and they're blaming Moses for the circumstance, because what they believe, there's faith going on, but it's not biblical and spiritual faith. They believe they're about to die. They believe that the army of Pharaoh is about to come and pour out Pharaoh's wrath for them leaving upon them. That's why they say, it would have been better for you to just leave us in our position, our circumstance of slavery. Now, they've already forgotten, we don't want to go too far off into this, but when they were slaves, what were they doing that caused the Lord to send Moses to deliver them? They were crying out to the Lord. They were crying out in despair, "Oh Lord, help us. Oh Lord, this slavery circumstance is crushing us. help us, have mercy on us, be gracious to us. So the Lord sends Moses, delivers them out. Now they're crying out and saying, Lord, why did you send Moses? But it's not hearts of faith. It's hearts of grumbling, complaining, and blaming. So what does Hebrews mean? I mean, you don't have to go back there. Let me just reread that one verse, the last verse that we're focused on. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. All right, well, we left off at the end of verse, we're back in Exodus now. We left off at the end of verse 13, or verse 12 is the people are complaining about Moses. And here's Moses' response to them in verse 13. And Moses said to the people, fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent. Now we know how the story unfolds there. The Lord says to Moses, don't cry to me anymore. Just hold out your staff over the sea and watch and see what I do. And so he holds out his staff, and the Lord splits the waters of the Red Sea miraculously, amazingly. He dries the ground underneath that water and causes it to be a dry pathway so that the people of God can cross on dry ground. And when push comes to shove, at the key moment, the people that are following Moses have two options. They can stay there on the shore of the Red Sea and deal with Pharaoh and his army, or they can follow Moses, who started out across the pathway, the supernatural pathway that the Lord has provided across the Red Sea. And when the rubber meets the road, they actually cross the Red Sea. And the Lord, in spite of their character flaws, in spite of their weakness, credits them with crossing the Red Sea by faith. Now, what that tells me is this. Faith can be passed on to others by the influence you have upon them. They were complaining and grumbling and blaming Moses, but rather than react to their complaint and their blaming, Moses gave them a powerful word of exhortation and encouragement to trust in the Lord. And then God displayed his power once more for them, and they found grace to trust the Lord and cross the Red Sea, and they successfully made it to the other side of the sea. They did so because, in a sense, the faith of Moses rubbed off on them. Now, that doesn't mean that from that day forward, they believed God just as strongly as Moses believed God. Because we know how the story unfolds. They never really arrived at the depth of a faith relationship with the Lord that Moses maintained for the 40 years of their wilderness journey. But on this day, they were people of faith. They didn't start out the day as people of faith, but they ended the day as people of faith because of the exhortation and encouragement of Moses. They received his word of encouragement, his faith rubbed off on them, and they found grace to trust God enough to actually cross the Red Sea. Now, the importance of that is this. You didn't come to be a person of faith just out of the blue. By the grace of God, somebody's faith prior to you rubbed off on you. And you're in a position now where you have been given opportunities or will be given opportunities by the Lord, and it will usually be in the worst possible circumstance. This was not an ideal circumstance that either Moses or the people would have chosen for themselves. Their lives were on the line and being threatened by Pharaoh's chariots. But it's in that moment where Moses had the opportunity given to him for his faith to rub off on them. And because he was anchored to the Lord in that moment, they found grace from the Lord to follow his example. And at least for this one shining moment, the entire nation was a nation of faith. And they successfully made it to the other side. And they celebrated as Pharaoh's army exercised a kind of faith themselves. It was a kind of faith. It just wasn't true faith and biblical faith, and it certainly wasn't faith in the Lord. It was more faith in Pharaoh. They had enough faith to follow the Israelites into the midst of the Red Sea. But of course, because their faith wasn't in the Lord did not safeguard their passage entirely across that pathway, and he brought the waters of the ocean crashing down upon their heads. All right, we will stop there in our study of the faith of Moses, and we'll pick up with the faith of Israel as the story continues in the transition into the promised land at the end of their wilderness journey, and a brief overview of some of the great heroes of faith that are mentioned without greater detail being added to their story as we move a little further into chapter 11, Lord willing, next Thursday night. God bless you. God bless you.